Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Delta variant continuing to be front and center, especially as we think about the economic outlook for the remainder of the year. Katie, we certainly thought that we'd be in a different place just a few months ago. In fact, I got to tell you, I mean, I think I've talked about this a little bit, but I was supposed to go to a wedding next week in Mexico, and concerns about the Delta variant the wedding is still happening, but we decided that our risk tolerance is not high enough to actually fly to San Diego, get on a bus and cross the border with a bunch of people who may or may not be vaccinated, because that's how we're getting to this wedding. And we decided not to go.
Yeah, in a darkly kind of humorous way, it's interesting to see this wedding boom collide with this surge in new cases. The fact that everyone who was supposed to get married in 2020, early 2021, has now pushed off their wedding to around this time. It was supposed to be safe. It's not safe. I'm in the same boat as you, Tim. My cousin is getting married in October. I hope he's not listening. It's an indoor wedding. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Okay. I really hope your cousin's not listening.
Sorry, James.
No You're offense, out there. James. Well, one of the reasons we really like to check in with our next guest is because he has such a good pulse on what exactly is happening with the state of the virus, especially in the tri-state area. Brian Granulati is Chief Executive Officer of Atlantic Health System. He joins us now on the phone from Morristown, New Jersey. Atlantic Health System serves nearly 5 million people in 11 New Jersey counties, 7 hospitals, 17,000 team members, and nearly 900 COVID-19 patients were at Atlantic hospitals at the peak of the pandemic in April of 2020. Brian, great to have you back on the show. Give us an update on how many COVID patients you have right now in the Atlantic Health System.
Sure. Thanks, Tim. This morning, we had 72 patients who were hospitalized at our hospitals throughout New Jersey.
A lot lower than what we saw at the peak of the pandemic in April of 2020. Do you consider the Delta variant having peaked here yet?
You know, the Delta variant is the predominant variant in New Jersey, and it is the majority of the cases that we sequence and the state sequences. So I think it is the main variant, and it's going to be with us for a while.
Well, let's talk about that since, like you say, the Delta variant could be with us for a while. You're seeing more employers and businesses require masks again. I mean, how else can people guard against the Delta variant? Because, I mean, at least I've heard that it's much more contagious than just the coronavirus itself.
So the first thing that people can do is get vaccinated.
Right.
And I think if you look throughout this country and see where the situation is different than it is here at the hospitals in New Jersey. In other words, the hospitals are being overwhelmed. It's a direct result of unvaccinated people getting sick, and they get very sick. The second thing is to just, again, use those common sense principles that we use throughout the pandemic. It's, you know, stay socially distanced if possible, particularly if you don't know the vaccine status of somebody, and wear your mask. I don't know about you guys, but whenever I go into a deli, whenever I go into a shopping center, I put a mask on because I just don't know.
Yeah, same. Look, same with me. And anyone who listens to this show knows that I take these precautions very seriously. Hey, excuse me, Brian. You mentioned vaccinations and the need to get vaccinated. It's with 17,000 employees at Atlantic Health System, are you requiring vaccinations for your employees?
So starting at the beginning of July, we put in place what we call a choice program. And that choice is that you either get vaccinated or you get routinely tested once or twice a week. And to just give you some context for that, at the beginning of July, 71% of our team members had been vaccinated. They had at least one vaccination. Today, 86% of our team members are fully vaccinated, and the balance of them undergo routine testing. So what that does is it protects our patients, it protects other team members, but it also gives people a choice about how they want to achieve that. And I think you've seen that approach of giving people choice being adopted by many other organizations, including those here in the state of New Jersey.
And so, Brian, broadening it out from the Atlantic health system, you know, you mentioned that the best protection against the Delta variant is getting vaccinated, but feels like at least in the U.S., everyone who wants to be vaccinated at this point has had some form of access to a jab. So I'm curious, you know, at a broad nationwide level, how do you convince the holdouts?
Well, I think you're starting to see that occur. Because it's been my belief that this pandemic, depending on how close you've been to it, really influences how you think about it. So in other words, here in the greater New York area, I think all of us are traumatized by what occurred starting in December and running through April. And I know in other parts of the country, there was a very low incidence of the virus. And now we're seeing that those tables get turned. And so I'm encouraged by the vaccination statistics nationally, and we're starting to see them go up in a pretty significant way, particularly in those areas where people were not vaccinated, because now they can see the ravage of this virus, and they can see it in their line of sight, and I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
We're never going to change the minds of people who are dug in on this. But those fence sitters, I think, are getting off the fence and starting to get vaccinated, and I encourage them to continue.
A very good message to end on. It's not too late to get vaccinated. Brian Granulati, Chief Executive Officer at Atlantic Health System, joining us from Morristown, New Jersey. Brian, thanks so much. It's always great to get your thoughts on the latest with the virus. Katie, it's absolutely mind-boggling that only 72 patients are in hospitals for Atlantic Health Systems right now, down from 900 just back in 2020.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the NFL season, it starts tomorrow night, Dallas at Tampa Bay. It's certainly a sign that summer is over and fall is here, but also a time for fantasy and, of course, sports betting. Joining us now for an update on the business and more is Amy Howe, president and interim CEO of FanDuel. She joins us on the phone from Los Angeles. Amy, it's really great to have you on Bloomberg Business Week Radio. Give us an update on the business. How would you characterize sports betting activity on the platform right now?
Thanks, Tim. It's really great to be here. So listen, we are just coming off of our second earnings call where we had a phenomenal first half of the year. You know, we delivered over $900 million in revenue. As we look at the forecast for the full year, we're projecting to be about $2 billion. So the regulatory tailwinds that we've seen in the sportsbook space specifically continue, and we're incredibly excited about NFL as we step into the regular season tomorrow night, as you just said.
And so, Amy, great to have you with us. So this is FanDuel's first year as an NFL league partner. What should that mean for actual FanDuel users as the season kicks off?
Yeah, we're really excited about this this season in particular. You're right. It is the first year that we've been officially partnering with the NFL. And I think there's really a few cornerstones to that program. The first is we're really elevating our game. We partnered up with, we think, one of the best agencies out there with Wieden and Kennedy. We have a great national ad campaign called Every Moment. And, you know, this is really about how do we amplify those moments for that NFL fan, right, from the great, generous pregame offers we have. We have a $1,000 risk-free bet to showcasing that live betting product during the broadcast. So that's going to air this week. We're really excited about that. But with the NFL partnership, we're also going to have an opportunity to integrate the highlights directly into our app, right? So we're going to make it much easier for that NFL fan to stay connected to those big betting moments. And then, you know, we also realize that there's a casual fan out there who may be just getting introduced to the category, and you may be sitting in a state, right, where sports betting isn't yet legalized. So with the NFL in conjunction with some of our other partners, we have some really terrific free-to-play games, right? We have a high-low game that's going to be presented by Phil Sims and Boomer Esiason. These are really easy to play. They're free in all 50 states, and any fan could win $1 million. So there's a lot to look forward to. I think this is going to be a really exciting season, and hopefully we'll keep the fans back in the stadiums throughout the duration of the season.
Amy, you joined FanDuel less than a year ago in February of 2021. Before that, you were at Live Nation, and you served as Global Chief Operating Officer of Ticketmaster. And I'm wondering what it's been like to join this company and become its interim CEO just in the last couple of months in the middle of a pandemic when so many of members of your workforce are presumably working remotely.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's interesting because it's kind of connecting both worlds for me, right? I mean, as I look at the return of live sports and live entertainment, you know, I have a lot invested in that because I managed through the biggest shutdown of the live entertainment industry. But I would say this is a once-in-a-career opportunity, right, to be able to step into a sector that has the kind of momentum it has, but also to do that with the number one leading global gaming operator is really exciting. So couldn't be happier with my decision, but I'm also I'm pulling for everybody in live sports and live entertainment.
And so, Amy, you mentioned that FanDuel's latest earnings report was particularly strong. So I want to talk about the competition for a little bit, because Dow Jones reported last month that ESPN is finally getting into sports betting. It signed multi-year deals with DraftKings and Caesars. How does FanDuel maintain its edge as sort of the competitive landscape heats up?
Yeah, listen, I think FanDuel has a big part of our advantage has been the scale that we have, right? If we close out at $2 billion in revenue, that puts us about 50% ahead of the field. And there's really two big differentiators that have gotten us there. One is, we have the most distinctive product out there. We've been the number one downloaded sportsbook app for quite some time. And a big part of that is we have been first to market with some great innovations, right? Same game parlay. We've had since 2019. We have more betting markets than many operators. So continuing to innovate and make sure that we give the consumers exactly what they need from a product perspective is really objective number one. And then from a marketing perspective, right, we have scale that many others don't. I think our partnership with the NFL, many of the leagues and many of the meeting partners has been a core part of our advantage. So we're going to keep at it. We came out of Q2 with a 45% share of the sportsbook market, and lots of great runway to capture as we look ahead with new states coming online.
Hey, Amy, about a year ago, if you were talking to us, we'd be asking you about the narrative that had emerged at the beginning of the pandemic that many people who were at home weren't necessarily able to bet on live sports. So what they were doing was they were betting on meme stocks. And they were betting on the stock market and using commission-free trading platforms to do so. I'm wondering how you could talk a little bit, or if you could talk a little bit about the way that activity has ebbed and flowed, especially as it is related to sports coming back online and people potentially going back to the office at least a few days a week. And if you're seeing any sort of connection there, share with us the data.
Sure. So the first thing I would say is during the pandemic, we certainly learned that consumers love to bet. They view this as part of their entertainment experience. And so even though some of the professional sports were shut down, they found alternative things to bet on, right? We had Korean table tennis, believe it or not, was one of the most bet on activities during the pandemic. But they were, betting on politics and the Bachelorette. So we've created a platform that allows consumers to engage, and it's really part of their the entertainment. To your question on what are we seeing as we return to normal, so far the data has been very compelling in that this is holding up, right? This online betting, not just in sports, but in casino gaming and racing and other activities, is here to stay. So so far, so good. And I think a big part of that is we have created a platform that really enhances that live entertainment experience, right? So even if you're at the venue, it doesn't matter where you are. We're a mobile-first product, and so you can access that anywhere. So far, so good.
And Amy, we have just about 30 seconds, but Jefferies put out a note about your parent company, Flutter, and one of the positive catalysts they cited was a potential IPO for FanDuel. So I was wondering if you could talk us through any possibilities there about going public.
Yeah, the only thing I would say is, you know, back in May, Flutter was very clear that the board continues to evaluate a whole range of strategic options. And what I'd say is here in the U.S., we're continue to stay focused on the objective, which is really being the number one mobile gaming operator in North America. So,
all right, we're going to have to leave it there. Amy Howe, president and interim CEO at FanDuel. She joins us on the phone from Los Angeles just one day ahead of the kickoff of the NFL season for 2021.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
It's Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Tim Stenovic. Carol Masser is out today. In her place is Katie Greifeld, Bloomberg News cross-asset reporter, also my co-host of Quick Take Stock, airing each and every day at noon Eastern Time on Bloomberg Quick Take. Well, the trial of Elizabeth Holmes, the former CEO of Theranos, who was once dubbed the world's youngest female self-made billionaire, kicks off today. She faces a dozen counts of fraud and conspiracy that could send her to prison for as long as 20 years if she's convicted. Joining us now from right outside the courthouse in San Jose, California, is Ed Ludlow, West Coast correspondent for Bloomberg News. Also joining us is June Grasso, Bloomberg News legal analyst. She's the host of Bloomberg Law, airing weeknights at 10 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. She joins us from the Access Line here in New York City. Ed, I want to start with you because you're on the ground there. As I mentioned, she faces a dozen counts of fraud and conspiracy, but what exactly are Holmes and Sonny Balwani charged with?
Yeah, so they're essentially charged with wire fraud, and how the prosecution are boiling it down is basically two schemes. One scheme to defraud investors out of their money. The other scheme to defraud consumers and doctors that went through the Theranos service to go through lab tests. And we've had the opening arguments from both sides. And what's interesting is the prosecution leaning very heavily on the idea that Holmes was knowledgeable of the issues with the technology and also the issues that was causing customers, that frankly, she lied. And because the company got to a stage where it had run out of money, it was desperate. And so, according to the prosecution, Holmes misled investors to keep the project alive. The defense have played the cards close to their chest, so to speak, but they've leant very heavily on the idea simply that Holmes believed fully, not just in what the company was trying to achieve, which was to bring down the cost of lab tests, but that it worked and that she was acting in good faith in that belief.
And so, Juno, I'm curious, are we actually going to hear from Elizabeth Holmes herself? Is she expected to take the stand?
That is the big question, and that's usually the question in every trial. Will a defendant take the stand? Because that is the biggest gamble and the most important question that the defense has to answer. Now, in this case, the defense has hinted that she may likely take the stand, but I noticed from what Ed said, they didn't mention it in their opening statement. So I think that they're playing along right now and seeing whether or not she will take the stand, because if she does take the stand, the prosecution is going to have so much ammunition to use against her, including a deposition she gave to the SEC after the collapse of Theranos, where some 600 times she said, "I don't know." So it's going to be very, very hard if she takes the stand. She's going to be faced with a lot of what she has said before. And of course, she has done countless media interviews, and there'll be a lot that they can cross-examine her with. So I think, but if she does put up the defense that we expect, but apparently it wasn't mentioned in the opening statement, we expect the defense to be that she was under the sway of Sonny Balwani, who was her lover at one point and the president of the Theranos, and that she suffered from mental and physical and sexual abuse, and that it was basically unable, she was basically unable to form intent. But they didn't say that in the opening, so that's kind of leaves me guessing. What's happening?
Yeah, it remains to be seen what the defense ultimately decides on for a strategy. Hey, Ed, since you're on the ground there, just give us an update on what it's actually like. And in this time of a pandemic, what's happening inside the courtroom? Are you able to go in? Are people who are not totally, actually involved in the case, like reporters, able to actually go in and see?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I actually was talking to the security guards here at San Jose District Court, and they were saying they've never seen anything like this. The sheer volume and media presence.
Wow.
There were people here at 4 a.m. local time, 5 hours before proceedings began, queuing in order to get in because of the COVID protocols, one in, one out. There is a courtroom which has a limited capacity, and then an overflow room with only 40 seats. And I can tell you there are dozens of reporters and members of public still outside who are unable to get in. And one interesting point, you know, maybe June has come on this, but given the public interest in this case, there's no audio feed. There's no Zoom feed. So the only way to know is to be inside the room. Just very quickly on what June said, you know, one of the points that the prosecution kind of dangled to the jury without going into detail is they do have text messages. They do have emails which they say demonstrate Elizabeth Holmes was fully aware of the defects with the technology. And in one instance, they cited some communication with Holmes's brother, who she'd hired into the company, and he had flagged issues with the technology. So that's just one of the points that June was talking to there.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to watch. And I mean, I think we all read the book, Bad Blood. It was fantastic.
Yep. So count me in that group.
Yeah,
that club,
right?
Twice.
I would be in that courtroom if I could be. But June, I know that the trial hasn't even started yet, but let's talk about what kind of sentence Holmes could be facing. Maximum sentence of 20 years. Is there any read on how likely that will be?
That sounds like when they do the projections, they tell you what the most she could get is. And that sounds like it's pretty far out there. I mean, you have a woman who has never been in trouble with the law before. I'm sure she's going to have lots of people, you know, writing letters on her behalf and saying that, you know, some of the good she's done in the community. So I doubt that it would be that much, but she's facing considerable time. And it also depends on, you know, how many of these charges. Is she going to be found guilty of all the charges, of the wire fraud? So it all depends, but 20 sounds like a lot more than would ever be given to her.
Hey, June, just in the last 20 seconds that we have with you, what's a realistic expectation for how long we can expect this trial to take?
They're saying 3 to 4 weeks, and trials often take longer than they say they will. They have a list of 180 witnesses, which of course is not what the prosecution is going to call, and the defense has a list of 50-some. So it's going to take a long time, but just how long, it's hard to sort of figure out at this point.
June Grasso, Bloomberg News legal analyst, also the host of Bloomberg Law, airs weeknights at 10 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Also joining us live from San Jose, Ed Ludlow, West Coast correspondent for Bloomberg News. He's outside the courtroom in San Jose. I do expect it, just given what we see with trials, Katie, that 3 to 4 weeks, I would be really surprised if it actually got wrapped up by then. We'll, of course, have to wait and see, and we'll bring you updates throughout, of course.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It's the Drive to the Close. We're just over 10 minutes away from market close on this Wednesday, September 8th, 2021, a shortened trading week. We see red across the screen, the Dow and the S&P 500 both down more than 2/10 of 1%. The Dow down close to 3/10 of 1%. The Nasdaq down more than 6/10 of 1%. 1%. Joining us now from Chicago is Sean Cruz, Senior Market Strategist at TD Ameritrade. He joins us on the phone from Chicago. Sean, it's great to have you back on the show. Hey, take us into today's trade and really what we're seeing, because if we do indeed, as the way things go right now, see the S&P 500 closing lower today, will be the third day in a row of declines on the S&P 500. We haven't seen a streak like that since July of this year.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting really just to see how markets behave coming out of August when they were charging up to new all-time highs, and really started to wonder was there going to be maybe a little bit of a slowdown in that selling. But starting out the month, it looks like there has been a little bit of a rollover, and I think one major issue there is the concern about what is going to happen with monetary policy. When is tightening really going to occur? Even if that is just a pullback in asset purchases, the assumption is maybe not at September, but still probably by the end of the year. And then the other thing is really the Delta variant, and what does that mean if we aren't entirely out of the clear of the Delta variant, but you have a Federal Reserve that is still signaling that there is some tightening on the horizon here. And I think that is really why you're seeing some profit-taking off of some of these all-time highs.
Well, Sean, let's stick with the Delta variant, because it was interesting. Today we got warnings from Goldman, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, all warning that we could see some turbulence coming in U.S. equities. And the common denominator between those warnings seemed to be the Delta variant, along with decelerating growth. Where do you fall on that debate? Do you also see some turbulence ahead, or, you know, could we, after this bout of profit taking, could we continue to just grind higher from here like we have been?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with what they're seeing out of the economy, and I think it makes sense that you're going to have to come out and maybe downgrade your GDP forecast. If you think about the economic surprise indicator, I know Bloomberg has one, there's a few others out there. One thing is consistent, and that is going into August, they were sort of teetering on dipping into negative territory, but we have now seen them move pretty solidly into a negative territory, meaning the data coming out was significantly undershooting what economists were expecting. So I think it makes sense you are going to see them come out and revisit some of those forecasts, and maybe not put out an entirely doom and gloom forecast, but maybe just acknowledge that there are going to be some headwinds hitting the economy, and that is going to slow down the pace of this recovery.
Hey, Sean, I want to go to the 2 o'clock hour, right at 2 o'clock, when we saw those Fed Beige Book headlines cross the wire, that the Delta variant is a reason for deceleration, that economic growth downshifted slightly at a moderate pace. Interestingly enough, we didn't really see the S&P 500 move lower on that news. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the market was already sort of expecting a lot of that news to come out. Yeah. And I think what they're seeing out here is it's sort of this outlook there, they are acknowledging some of those issues, but they didn't really sound the alarm too much.
Yeah.
And I think that
they
might
did
be
say that most businesses right in most district they said that businesses in most districts remained optimistic, Sean.
Yeah, and I think that's the case where businesses are acknowledging that there is a little bit of slowdown. This is impeding some of the recovery. I mean, look at what we saw in the leisure and hospitality sector. Yeah. That is sort of right there at the focal point of reopening, getting back to some sense of normalcy. Also going to be the first to feel any sort of reinstitution of restrictions by officials. So I think looking at the jobs data we got out today as well, it shows there's plenty of openings out there. And I think the assumption is as soon as we can start to lift some of those restrictions, you'll see that almost snap right back. And I think that's why markets are okay with acknowledging the Delta variant as a slowdown. But we have heard from quite a few health officials that we could get through this Delta variant spike here in the next couple of weeks. And if that is the case, then you will probably be able to return back to normal hopefully before too long.
And Sean, I want to talk about bonds, because I was playing with some correlations this morning, and it looks like if there's a signal that the bond market is sending to equities, no one's picking up the phone. Because if you look at correlation between futures and the S&P 500 on a 90-day basis and between yields and the NASDAQ 100, those tech stocks, correlations are basically meaningless right now. And I mean, if you go back to the start of the year or earlier in the year, it felt like tech stocks in particular were just following wherever yields went. So I'm curious why we're starting to see that dynamic breakdown and those two asset classes kind of go their separate ways.
Well, what I think when you're looking at yields and any sort of relationship with equities, I'd like to look at and take a step back and look at the bigger picture. At the start of the year, you actually had yields trading in a pretty nice range between 100 and 120 basis points. You really saw things get dicey and markets start responding to what was going on. The market, when we broke out of that and started charging higher, if you think about it, we closed and finished up February moving from about 120 basis points, and then probably about the end of March, we were up at 175 basis points. And then we've since dropped back down and hit a low of about 110 basis points once again in July. So what we've been seeing lately is sort of this range that we've seen bonds trade in, the 10-year yields that I'm referring to, between 125 basis points and just under 140 basis points. So I think if you see us break out above 140, maybe go from challenge 150 basis points, or even break lower, then you might see some sort of response out of equities. But I don't expect that to be a major driver or a major correlation on a day-to-day basis, as long as we're staying within this range.
And so what is going to be the driver for the equity market from here then? I mean, are we just going to be trading off of, the U.S. COVID curve, or what's in the driver's seat now?
I think it's going to be some of those second order effects from what happens with the COVID curve. I think as you start to get more of a broad-based reopening economy, which I said hopefully sooner rather than later, we're going to get a really good idea of how labor markets are going to really start to recover. We're going to get an idea of what sort of wage inflation we can expect, and an idea of when bottlenecks are going to start to clear up. So I think a lot of this is really centering around whatever those knock-on effects that lead to changes or movements in inflation expectations. I think that's going to be the next big item to look at, but there could be a few things that have to happen first, clearing up the effects of the Delta variant, getting an idea of what the labor market recovery is going to look like, and then from there we can start to get an idea of where some of these bottlenecks in the supply chain, where some of the wage inflation is going to fall. I think that'll give us a little bit more clarity on that, and markets will be more comfortable making a more pronounced, I think possibly strong move in either direction once we have a better idea of what that is.
Sean Cruz, a senior market strategist at TD Ameritrade, joining us on the phone from Chicago. Sean, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.